The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, less than 2 weeks to Election Day, Karl Rove helps us with a look at the Senate.
If the Republicans hold Pennsylvania with Emmett Oz, they stand a very good chance of taking the Senate.
We'll hear from the incumbent in another tight race, Ron Johnson, in his effort for another term representing Wisconsin.
Well, again, he can't defend, nor can Biden defend their policies, so all they can do is lie, distort, and assassinate my character and my campaign.
We'll take a closer look at the president's dark speech from Philadelphia's Independence Hall.
MAGA Republicans do not respect the Constitution. They do not believe in the rule of law. They do not recognize the will of the people. They promote authoritarian leaders, and they fan the flames of political violence.
Brandon Reichert.
And that was meant to intimidate. That was subliminal intimidation that was meant to goad fear.
It's a speech that will stand out in history.
Without question, the ugliest speech ever given by a president of the United States.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com. Follow me, please, on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. We'll begin with the most important story from here until the second Tuesday in November, Election Day. The country is languishing under decades-high inflation and record-high gas and grocery prices while the administration continues spending with hopes it can buy an election with votes, especially the votes of those for whom they are forgiving student loans. The greatest check and balance the nation can provide to President Biden and two congressional chambers controlled by Democrats is a shift in control of one or both of those houses. That would mean Republican control of both the House and the Senate. Karl Rove, the architect, joined my program earlier this week. Let's run down the map, Karl Rove. There are four holds that the Republicans need: Wisconsin, North Carolina, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. What do you think of each of those?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good about Wisconsin. It's going to be a tough race right to the end because it's a battleground state that's settled by, you know, several tens of thousands of votes. I think Ron Johnson is running a good campaign, and his opponent, if he takes one step to the left, is going to fall off the edge of the earth, which is why Mandela Barnes is attempting to he won't say the word progressive. And he is running as fast and as furious away from his previous positions as he can get. But there's plenty of that, whether it's, you know, defunding the police or, you know, abolishing private health insurance. There are lots of crazy things that he has said over the years. And Johnson's going to have a wonderful opportunity to make use of those. I'm impressed with how Ted Budd is uniting the Republican Party in North Carolina. I think he's going to be all right. J.D. Vance has had a rocky start, but the state is red, and as long as lots of people are in there spending money, I'm involved in a group that's spending, you know, several tens of millions of dollars in American Crossroads Senate Leadership Fund, and I think at the end of the day he'll be all right. And then Pennsylvania, which, you know, control of the U.S. Senate could come down to who wins that race. If the Republicans hold Pennsylvania with Mehmet Oz, they stand a very good chance of taking the Senate.
Now, Dr. Oz is getting better. He's been on this show once. He's coming back, and I was impressed. And John Fetterman is hurt, and I have sympathy for him and prayers for him, but I don't know if you can win incapacitated. Carl, does that happen?
Well, it occasionally happens, but you have to be enormously popular or politically very adroit. And, you know, he started out ahead, but I think people are looking at him and saying, is he up to the job? Is he up to the task? But in a way, it's sort of like, you know, hiding another weakness, which is, again, much like Mandela Barnes, here's a guy with extreme views. I mean, he literally, you know, said, you know, referring to another state official, he said this other state official opined that you could let a third of the people out of Pennsylvania state prisons without affecting public safety. And Fetterman said, I agree with that. And I think it's very profound. And I mean, again, once again, this guy is very very much to the left of the Democratic Party in his state, and yet he won the nomination. And Dr. Oz has a great opportunity to draw some distinctions there.
Last time Ron Johnson was on, I said that I thought Fetterman was the most left-wing Senate candidate I've ever seen, and he argued with me that Mandela Barnes is actually to the left of Fetterman. I don't think we have to decide that so much as point it out that it's a race to the left.
Exactly.
Let me go to the takeaways.
One quick thing about Wisconsin, I think Ron Johnson's having fun. If you look at the pictures this summer, Wisconsin, they have lots of local parades and festivals and, you know, and there he was having a fun time out there campaigning. And that's what you need is a happy warrior. And he appears to be a very happy warrior this time.
He is. Let's go through the five takeaways. I'll do them alphabetically. If the Republicans win any of these, I think Mitch McConnell will be the leader again. Arizona, Colorado, Georgia, New Hampshire, Washington. Let's start with Arizona. Blake Masters against incumbent Mark Kelly.
Well, first, let's start with one you left out, Nevada.
Oh, you're right. My gosh, how can I forget Adam? Oh, my, that's a given.
Well, I don't think it's a given, but he's running a very good campaign, and he's a friend of mine, and as I suspect he's a friend of yours, I think he's a wonderful human being and a great life story and a wonderful state attorney general, and I think he's going to win, which is our best shot for a pickup.
That's why I forget it, because, when you have to add something to your pickup list, that's good dag. You're right, Nevada, he is going to win. Now to Arizona.
Yep. Tough contest, got to unite the party, took some very strong, hard views during the primary. It's a state with a lot of Republicans, but it's got a lot of independents, and there's going to be a tough race. And my hope is that Peter Thiel continues to support Blake Masters, his former chief of staff and close friend, because there's not enough money to go around for all these races.
The surprise of the cycle is in Colorado with Joe O'Dea, Karl Rove, and I can't have him on enough. I like him so much. He's such a normal guy.
Well, but full disclosure, a week ago Monday, I did a fundraiser for him in Denver, took time out of my family vacation to go join him. I was blown away. First of all, he and I share something in common. We're both adopted. And what a wonderful guy. I mean, there's so much authenticity, the directness. Here's a guy adopted by a Denver cop and his stay-at-home mom, gets into trouble when he's a teenager. His father says, okay, we're going to send you to the Catholic school, got a partial scholarship, and you're going to work Saturdays and Sundays to pay the rest of your tuition. The Monsignors turn his life around, graduates, goes to a Carpenters Union apprenticeship program, becomes a union carpenter, works as a carpenter for 4 years, falls head over heels in love with an attractive Latina, follows her to Colorado State University. They work their way through school, get married, work their way through school. He graduates with a construction management degree from Colorado State. The two of them start a construction company, and it now is a large company that does most of the water projects in that part of the world. And he's a wonderful human being. And you look at him, you listen to him, you look him in the eye, and you just sense that this guy has enormous integrity. Tells you what he thinks, humble. I was just completely blown away, and I think you're right. This is a very interesting contest, and the fact that the Democrats spent $10 million to try and defeat him in the Republican primary says that they know something about his ability to garner votes.
All right, Georgia and New Hampshire. We got about 2 minutes. I'm in three races. I'm very high on Herschel's improving ability to talk and talk to people, directly as one guy to one voter. What do you think about Herschel?
Yeah, look, he has an enormous strength, which is that there's an enormous reservoir of goodwill. And you're right.
Yes.
He's not been a political candidate. He's been a pro football player and a role model, somebody who's talked about the challenges that he faced in his own life and how he found the courage to ask for help. I think he's an inspiring figure, and you're right. He's getting better as a candidate, and his opponent is a left-winger. I mean, Raphael Warnock would be right at home representing the state of Massachusetts or, Vermont. I mean, it's like, he'd be a good California congressman from the Bay Area. I mean, so this is going to be a barn burner, very expensive, and going to go right down to the end. And fortunately, Herschel's on the ballot with Brian Kemp, who's going to, I think, help him by making it. There are not going to be a lot of people who vote for Brian Kemp and then vote for Raphael Warnock.
New Hampshire has to nominate Chuck Morrison, then he can win. I don't think anybody else can beat Maggie Hassan. I'm a realist. Do you agree with me, Carl Rove?
I totally agree with you. And please, would you start saying the name of the state correctly? New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
You got a little tone there. New Hampshire. Absolutely. Chuck Morris has been a great ally in passing Governor Chris Sununu's package. He's a good conservative with sensible views. He can beat Maggie Hassan, and you're right. He's the only one who can put it together in a general election. And again, the Democrats are spending, Chuck Schumer's trying to nominate a guy named Baldock by spending about $7 or $8 million here in the last 2 weeks of the campaign in this little state in the Northeast. So
wow.
It's a sign of the desperation of the Democrats that they want to stop Chuck Morris.
Tiffany Smiley, all the way across the country in Washington State.
She's a terrific candidate in a tough state, as you know, but she is an unbelievable. It's funny, two of our best candidates are in two of the toughest states, Colorado and Washington State, but she's terrific.
I hope you listen to this program each and every week. If you just happened to miss last week, we had Pennsylvania's Dr. Oz, Georgia's Herschel Walker, Arizona's Blake Masters, and Colorado's Joe O'Dea as guests. Get that episode at townhallreview.com. Another race to watch, Ron Johnson, who Rove just called a happy warrior in his effort to secure a third term representing the people of Wisconsin. Senator Johnson was a guest on my program. Carl Rove agreed with you that Mandela Barnes, I think he agreed with you that Mandela Barnes is to the left of John Fetterman. Mandela Barnes is also in his own trouble. Let me play a clip for you yesterday from ABC 12 in Milwaukee. Here's Mandela Barnes explaining why he couldn't join the president of the United States in his own backyard.
You met with labor workers in union yesterday. You also did not appear with the president yesterday. Why was that?
Well, we had a pretty packed schedule. Had to get around the state. I'm really grateful that the president has shown his support for the labor movement here in Wisconsin.
When you ditch the president is radioactive. What does that tell you about Mandela Barnes and Joe Biden?
Well, again, he can't defend, nor can Biden defend their policies. So all they can do is lie, distort, and assassinate my character in my campaign. But again, I think that was one of three questions he's answered in about the last month? And it really wasn't that hard a question, was it? You know, I mean, they ought to be asking the hard question. What would you do to solve inflation? I mean, you've been for all this massive spending that caused inflation. You know, you're supportive of the Green New Deal. I mean, that's what's driving purposefully up the cost of gas. Do you still support that? I mean, those are the questions they should be asking, but they don't have access to him because the guy is in hiding.
They won't even ask him the question, or will they ask him the question about that face plant in Philly by Joe Biden, the red setting speech? What did you make of that speech, Senator Johnson?
Oh, it was horrible. I've never seen a president give a more divisive speech, and that was the most divisive speech I've ever heard a U.S. president give. But that's what they've been doing. They have been dividing this country. They've been dividing it for decades, but they've really put it into hyperdrive now because they want power. They crave power. I don't understand it, but that's what the left wants. They want power over your life.
Coming up.
MAGA Republicans do not respect the Constitution. They do not believe in the rule of law. They do not recognize the will of the people. They promote authoritarian leaders, and they fan the flames of political violence.
We'll look at President Biden's dark speech out of Philadelphia when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. President Biden won the nomination of his party in large part because he was understood to be moderate. He was the moderate Democrat, the centrist, with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders far to his left. That's how he sold himself. He's governed, though, from the hard left, further left than his former boss, President Obama. Biden's profligate spending has given us this record inflation. His soft-on-crime approach has left urban voters feeling at risk in their own cities. His debacle in Afghanistan left Americans dead and Americans trapped under the Taliban, our vast supply of military equipment in the hands of the Islamists. And so now he's trying to shift the narrative. but he did so in a disturbing way. Seth Leibson turned to Brandon Weikert, contributor to American Greatness, from AM 960, The Patriot in Phoenix.
Your take on Joe Biden's speech in Philadelphia last week, did he divide the nation further, or was the healer-in-chief giving us a little Clinton at Oklahoma, reuniting the country? I know, it's a loaded question, but I'd love to hear your take on it.
This was the most divisive speech I have heard any president give in my lifetime. I think that there are some real ethical questions in the sense that we had two uniformed Marines standing within eyesight of the cameras just off, you know, just behind the president as he was making what was clearly intended to be a campaign speech. He was, you know, that may even be a violation of the Logan Act.
I mean, he announced no new policy. He did not discuss any kind of national crisis unless the national crisis is the Republican Party's existence, right?
That's exactly right. And let's face it, this was also in the run-up to Donald Trump's big speech in Pennsylvania.
Right.
I think he preceded it by a few days.
Yep.
And so these are connected. This was not a presidential address. This was a partisan hack address. And actually, what he was doing, whether intentional or not, and I think at least for his minders, I think it was intentional. This was trying, I think, to trigger the, you know, elements of the extreme right and left into initiating some type of political conflict with each other. Biden had a red backdrop. He had the military. He had in their dress uniform two Marines standing there looking ominously toward the camera as Trump, as Biden is basically calling anybody who voted 76 million Americans.
Using a national monument, Trump, by the way, using.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Using that, and that was meant to intimidate. That was an intent, was subliminal intimidation that was meant to goad fear. You know, there's whole psychological studies about what the color red does to mass audiences.
Yep.
This was very, I mean, this was creepy. And this was the most divisive speech I've ever seen a sitting American president give. And furthermore, it was intended to be that one.
Yep.
It was intended.
Yep.
That is the key difference here, is there was intent. And that's the scary part.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Not only was it intended, I mean, if you read the speech, I mean, you've written speeches for folks I have. You know how speech writing works at a place like that. Everything is very carefully edited. It's seen by God knows how many eyeballs and how many drafts go back and forth. But they were very careful. They were exquisite in their ability to give him wiggle room to say later, well, I didn't say that. I didn't say this.
Yep.
And
he's already starting to do that.
He's already starting to do that. No, right. I don't mean Donald Trump's voters. That's, of course, what he meant.
That's exactly what he meant.
And you just wonder how much of that Joe Biden was in that speech and how much of the other advisors was in that speech. A lot of people said this was a Susan Rice production. Is that your sense?
Yeah, well, Susan Rice is the shadow president. You know, so this has got John Kerry, Susan Rice. This has got, you name a former Obama official. I wouldn't be surprised if Obama himself had a hand in giving inputs on the creation of this speech. This speech was unlike anything I've ever seen Biden give. This speech was completely out of character for him. This wasn't really Joe. This was the person who serves, or the people who serve as Joe's brain, kind of putting these really radical things there.
It is over a week since the president delivered that speech, but Dennis Prager, like many others, can't get it off his mind.
I'm still obsessed with the speech that the President of the United States gave last Thursday. Without question, the ugliest speech ever given by a President of the United States. He is the living opposite of Abraham Lincoln. On a scale of decency to indecency, they are 180 degrees apart. Abraham Lincoln spoke, and this was after hundreds of thousands of Union soldiers were killed in the fight against the South, secession, and slavery, with malice towards none and charity for all. This president is the opposite, with malice towards many and charity to my allies. Malice towards those who oppose me and charity to those who support me. Very difficult to overstate how awful that speech was. The list of things that he accused the MAGA Republicans of, all of which were lies, which is part of the fascination of the whole thing. Let me give you a rundown. MAGA Republicans do not respect the Constitution. Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic. They do not believe in the rule of law. They do not recognize the will of the people. They're working right now as I speak in state after state to give power to decide elections in America to partisans and cronies, to undermine democracy itself. They promote authoritarian leaders. They fan the flames of political violence that are a threat to our personal rights, to the pursuit of justice, to the rule of law, to the very soul of the country. They tried everything last time to nullify the votes of 81 million people. This time they're determined to succeed in thwarting the will of the people. They embrace anger. They thrive on chaos. They live not in the light of truth, but in the shadow of lies. MAGA Republicans look at America and see carnage and darkness and despair. They spread fear and lies, lies told for profit and power. Is there any parallel to that in American history? MAGA Republicans look at America and see carnage and darkness and despair. Well, we do see carnage, darkness, and despair. I will agree to that. That was accurate, at least for me. But indeed, there's carnage and darkness, all brought about by the left. Its acceptance of the violence of 2020, its celebration of the violence of 2020, its non-prosecution of the people who engaged in the violence of 2020. It's an interesting thing. I guess Joe Biden doesn't see carnage. I'll bet he is oblivious to the amount of violent crime and its ascension under his regime. And regime is what I use for the first time in my life with regard to an American administration. Well, MAGA Republicans, unser Unglück, our misfortune. Biden is not a Nazi, the Democrats are not Nazis. But the isolation of a segment of the population as the misfortune of a country has a very dark pedigree. People should be aware that these things can lead to very bad results. When a leader of a country tells the people of the country there's a segment of the country that is its misfortune.
Coming up.
We're never going to get an understanding of how far the possible military dimensions of their program have gone.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Wrong-headed and dangerous. Those are two words that come to mind as we look at the Biden administration's effort to renew the JCPOA. That's the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Obama-era agreement that our previous president entered into with the mullahs of Iran. President Trump, you will remember, constitutionally acted to abrogate that agreement. Mike Gallagher. The Congressman Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin was a guest on my program. So let's get to the serious stuff. And the serious stuff has to do with the JCPOA 2.0. I cannot believe we are still at the table with these people. Why is this a bad idea?
Okay, so a few issues at play. When Biden campaigned, he promised that he would get a deal that was longer and stronger than the original JCPOA. And remember, one of the many problems with the original JCPOA is that it was filled with sunset provisions. So some of the biggest constraints in the deal, such as they existed, expire. We've actually already blown past some of the sunset provisions, and the remaining most meaningful ones sunset at the end of this decade. So by all accounts, we've done nothing to make those sunsets disappear, make the provisions permanent. And there's nothing in the new JCPOA that's going to address the fact that any constraints on Iran's program simply evaporate in a matter of years. So obviously, if you're Iran, the best thing you would do, the smartest thing you would do, is just abide by the terms of this weak deal until it expires, and then you can crank up your nuclear program to an industrial-grade capacity. So that's point one. We are not going to get a longer or stronger deal. We're going to get a shorter or weaker deal. Well, now there's this new issue. If you remember, due to some heroic action on the part of Israeli intelligence, allegedly, we now know that the Iranians, as anyone with common sense could have told you, the Iranians had a nuclear weapons component to their nuclear program. The IAEA, the Nuclear Monitoring Organization, has an ongoing investigation into that very fact. But apparently one of the things the Iranians are demanding in order to sign this new, weaker Iran deal is for the IAEA to completely close the books on that investigation. So we're never going to get an understanding of how far the what's called PMD, the possible military dimensions of their program, have gone. And if you don't have that understanding, if you don't have that baseline understanding of how far they've gotten, how can you develop an inspections and verification regime that allows you to monitor any deal going forward? Exactly. The third and final thing I mentioned, though, there's many aspects of this deal we can get into. I think it's fair to say maybe the biggest political mistake former President Barack Obama made is because he knew this deal was so weak, he never submitted it to Congress for ratification as a treaty. I mean, it was an international agreement, a major international agreement, and he did it purely as an executive agreement or an agreement between himself and the supreme leader of Iran. And therefore, it did not survive his tenure in office. President Trump came in and he ripped up the deal. Similarly, President Biden is not just going to repeat President Obama's mistake. He's going to go a step further. And what we're hearing is they're going to insert a provision into the deal whereby if a future Congress or a future president abrogates the agreement, the Iranians will be allowed to snap back to massive advanced nuclear production. So you're basically in an unconstitutional fashion.
I haven't heard that before. Yeah, I have not heard that. That's wild. This is a cult. You may have been at the one time I went to the Aspen Institute. I don't go anymore because it's completely gone over the left edge. It was like going to a wake for the JCPOA. And it still is that way. But now it's become a cult. And they are cultish in their devotion. There is a picture in the Times of Israel this morning of Prime Minister Lapid standing in front of an F-35 saying to Iran, don't tempt us. And you know what will tempt Israel to strike will be this. This is a war-inducing agreement, as you've just described it, because Israel will feel like Joe Biden does not have their back.
I totally agree with that. And the fact is, and what makes this even more maddening, is we now have, for the first time in a long time, in a region that I've spent most of my adult life dealing with, that's frustrated our policy ambitions. Let's be honest. The Middle East is a difficult place to deal with. We now have, because of the Abraham Accords, a framework we can build off of. We have a recipe for stability in that region. And building off that growing cooperation between Israel and the Sunni Arab Gulf states, because they have a shared interest in countering Iran, is the path to geopolitical success in the Middle East. And if this administration jumps back into the arms of the mullahs so that John Kerry or whoever now can get a Nobel Peace Prize, they will screw up the foundation of the Abraham Accords. It will create more chaos in the Middle East. And then we'll be returning to the problem that we've had in multiple administrations, which is where we want to spend more time focusing on the Indo-Pacific, but we get sucked into a cauldron of chaos in the Middle East and undermine our alliance structure in the process. It makes no sense.
Coming up,
the people who are putting forth this image of black culture, which is a facade, is headed by white so-called progressives who pretend that they're an ally to black folks.
Uncle Tom, too, on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. There are a number of interesting dynamics we see unfolding in the American electorate today. In Texas, for example, we saw a special election in an 85% Hispanic district, and a Republican won, Myra Flores. And GOP support among blacks is up as well. But it does not come without some blowback. My friend Larry Elder is out with Uncle Tom, too. The producer, Chad Jackson, joined Sebastian Gorka.
To your question about why we felt the need to make a part two, whenever it comes to a lot of these liberal black professional race hustlers, they like to project what they do onto black conservatives, namely that as black conservatives, we suck up to white people. And so it was important that in Uncle Tom 2, we show you that these are the real sellouts, these black liberals, and we show you who exactly is behind the things that they're doing.
Now, you've used a very powerful, provocative phrase, race hustlers. I have this story in front of me from Breitbart. BLM executive Shalomaya Bowers siphons $10 million for himself from donors. So I guess it's not an exaggeration, Chad.
Yeah, these people, they are all too willing to use and exploit and exaggerate relations between black people and police officers, which for the most part across the country, studies show, is pretty cordial. But they take these one-off situations that happen that have nothing to do with race. They make it about race. They build protests around them. They burn down buildings, so on and so forth, all to make money, all to intimidate and threaten politicians, corporations, so on and so forth. But again, what we show in our film, in Uncle Tom 2, is that these are only pawns. They're useful idiots that are used by white Marxists. And so it's ironic that on the one hand, they present themselves as being pro-black, we're for blackness, black, 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 everything's about black. But when you lift the veil and pull back the curtain, you'll find that white Marxists are behind what they're doing.
I like your specificity, white Marxist. I've said repeatedly on this show, Chad, that America does have a serious race problem, and that race problem is left-wing liberals who are white. That's the problem. Now, I've seen clips from the show, and the first reaction I had as a white American is anger. Anger to what is portrayed in terms of what black America had in the 20s and even the 30s and how that was all ripped away from them. Is that one of the things people should feel when they look at what the left has done to black America?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what we're going for. It's important that black youth in particular know their real history, that they know that their great-grandfathers and grandmothers were patriots, that they loved this country, that they were church-oriented, and that they were making tremendous strides generation by generation. It wasn't until, and a lot of people are going to hate to hear this, but it wasn't until Marxist agitation, specifically under the guise of civil rights, came through and, in a sense, shifted the mindset of black youth in the 60s going into the 70s, where they were rebelling against the adult generation of their day, and they resolved to become more militant, particularly the youngsters, and not only that, but they were also influenced by blaxploitation, which was a category of entertainment around the time, which glorified hustling and pimping and prostituting, so on and so forth. And so as you get into the 90s and you have the introduction of gangster rap, demoralization has really done a number on the so-called black community in this country. And when you know, to the point you said you alluded to earlier, these people will have you believe that middle-class white Americans or white Southerners are enemies to black people, when in reality, the people who are putting forth this image of black culture, which is a facade, is headed by white so-called progressives who pretend that they're an ally to black folks.
Why the hell does black America vote for Democrats after the last 70 years, Chad? Can you just explain that for me?
Black people, unfortunately, were led into the Democrat Party by the civil rights movement. This is something that we expose in Uncle Tom 2, where before, when you had black people who were basically carrying on the baton, if you will, of the program set forth by Booker T. Washington, where one is required to cast down their bucket where they are, to make the most of their situation, to be a man, to be responsible, to take responsibility of your own life and that of your family. That was the way that the black community moved. And it wasn't until the sensationalism, the rhetoric that existed in the 60s, as it relates to black protests, where the onus was taken off the individual and put on the government. And so what we got as a result was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which many scholars believe was a good thing, but in reality, it expanded the role of government. It gave the government a say in how private-owned companies operate, and it acted as a threshold for even more such laws to come with regard to the government's role in private-owned companies. And what Marxists want is the government to own the means of production, namely to usurp basically the way that we conduct ourselves in the free market. And so,
but you're talking about events occurring, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. You'd think after maybe 40 years of being screwed over by the left, they would stop voting 93% for Democrats.
Yeah, you would think. But one of the things that they were able to figure out, because you have to keep in mind, these people, they have invested years and money, not only in the cognitive sciences, but the social sciences. And so they understand that if you can leverage political policy, you can maintain your stronghold on groups of people. And so whenever you're able to implant so-called civil rights leaders, and then you get out of that people like Jesse Jackson, people like Al Sharpton, you have this kind of revolving door of civil rights leaders who can keep towing the party line and keeping black people kind of in their place, so to speak, you'll always have that guaranteed voter class. And so when you look at other ethnic groups in this country, you don't see, oh, you have the Asian leaders, you have the, you know, Italian leaders, you have the, you know, Hispanic leaders. But for some reason, you have the black community and we have our so-called black leaders. This is because we have been, in a sense, indoctrinated into believing that we need such leaders, when in reality, we have just as much access to opportunities as literally anybody else in this country. We need to return to the authentic gospel. We need to return to that. Not only that, but we need to understand our place in this country as true American citizens, stop complaining, stop whining, and basically just grab life by the horns and be a man.
Catch Uncle Tom, too, at salemnow.com. Coming up.
And this fool done took $10 million and put it in his own personal piggy bank.
Black Lives Matter in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Kevin McCullough. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, the president takes a dark turn in his address to the nation from Philadelphia.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic.
What was the motive in delivering such a polarizing speech?
He's saying that they're less than you.
And it fits a pattern.
The president had actually called these Republicans semi-fascist.
The Biden administration works to undo Title IX protections for women and girls.
The word sex now includes gender identity.
And a look at the lack of theological depth in the church today.
Over a third of senior pastors believe good people can earn their way to heaven.
Be sure to join us and visit our website at ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Black Lives Matter. Perhaps no organization or network of activists leapt onto the scene like BLM in the wake of George Floyd's murder in May of 2020. Billed as a charity acting on behalf of black Americans, BLM was in fact ideological, hard left in fact. Now, and this is only the latest scandal, Shalomia Bowers, one of the leaders of BLM, is accused of siphoning $10 million. Yes, $10 million. Here's Brandon Tatum.
I just destroy Black Lives Matter every chance I get. Because they are such a fraudulent organization that took over the minds and the hearts of gullible Americans in 2020, had people burning down buildings, killing people, property damage in the billions. I mean, it just out of control behavior because a crackhead was killed by a bad cop, and they burnt down cities all over the country. They extorted money from guilty white people, raising hundreds of, I don't know how many millions of dollars they raised. We don't even know. It's $60 million floating around somewhere where nobody knows where it's at. Here's an article right here. There was a gentleman that Patrice Cullors, after she stepped down, she put him in charge, and he somehow funneled $10 million to his consulting firm. $10 million to his consulting. I just, Lord, help me. The amount of manipulation that came from Black Lives Matter is criminal. Black Lives Matter, and I say it on the airways, Black Lives Matter was a domestic terrorist organization. They use violence and coercion to push a political agenda. That is a terrorist organization. And then not only did they use violence, they extracted money and they manipulated the money for their own personal gain. I think it's Charlemagne Bowers. But Mr. Bowers and Patrice Cullors, between the two of them and BLM buying properties, y'all talking like $30 million just spent on personal use. Y'all you can't make this stuff up. You can't make it up. So this gentleman, Patrice Cullors, hired to do consulting to manage the donations that were coming in. And this fool done took $10 million and put it in his own personal piggy bank. But you take the people's money, you claim that you care about black lives, And black people are not benefiting from half of this money. They had so much influence around the world, and somehow black people found a way to mess it up. How in the world, with that much power and influence, why couldn't a group of black people actually do something for black people? Why couldn't they clean up the inner cities, build the schools better, get kids a better education, somehow have a contingency of dads, community leaders, curbing crime in the inner city? They could have done something. They didn't do nothing but pimp y'all. Straight hoodwinked. It's an incredible shame that that organization didn't do anything positive. I don't believe they did anything positive. What did they do? On the dead bodies of black men, they made a grift and they made money.
Thank you for joining us today. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. If you haven't signed up for our podcast yet, why not take a minute to do so? Just go to townhallreview.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann, producers David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Tim Gantner, Jacob Orduña, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.